Hey everybody, this is Dominique. Are you ready to do more with your life and money? Today we'll begin a series in which we'll unpack several myths that I have heard over almost a two-decade career in financial services. And we'll unpack it in a way so we'll see the truth and we'll expose these myths for the myths that they are. All right, stay tuned.
Are you tired of feeling like there's more to life that you're just not experiencing? Are you unmotivated by keeping up with the status quo? Are you ready to start living intentionally with your finances and creating the life you want? Get ready for Experiencing Financial Contentment with Dominique Henderson, a podcast focused on helping you create margin for the life you want to live by putting your money where your heart is. Each week, Dominique will help you explore the decisions you make around money so that you can achieve better results. Now, here's your host, Dominique Henderson.
Hey, everybody, we're back. This is Dominique Henderson, owner and founder of DJH Capital Management, where we are helping our clients achieve their ideal financial outcome, and host of Experiencing Financial Contentment, the podcast, where we uncover everything for financial literacy, economic empowerment, and personal development. So our job here today is to help you take the red pill of leaving the matrix of the average so that you can live a life of financial contentment and just do more with your life and money. If you're a repeat listener, we thank you for listening. And if you're new, hopefully we can uncover some truths that will help you have a paradigm shift when it comes to those three topics. Now, I have to make a confession. This is my, I've been away from the recording booth for a little while, at least my normal setup. And it's summer, it's June, it's hot in Texas, it's triple digits. And so the wife and I were recently out of this environment because it's so hot. And we went abroad. We celebrated 21 years of marriage. So shout out to my bride of 21 years, Miss Brianna Henderson. She is the glue that holds this thing all together when it's called relationship. So thankful for her. But anyways, on trips like that, what I get to do is I get to unwind a little bit, which I like. I love to do. I love to sit by the pool or go to the beach and take long walks and talk to my wife and just think through things. And one of the things that I thought about while I was on this most recent trip were some of the myths that surround financial advice and financial advisors. Specifically, in light of a ton of conversations that I've just had over nearly two decades. And so I thought, you know, it would be a good thing to probably unpack some of those instead of just letting them sit out there as myths, since I do love what I do and I love this industry and I would love to help people be more informed and break down a heuristic of thinking that may, let's say, disempower you or keep you from achieving your highest level that you need to attain in life. So from that standpoint, what happened is I had some extra time and I started writing this stuff on my trip and on the plane. And before long, I came up with like 20 myths. Now, I'm sure that there's more, but so there's a couple of housekeeping things. If you want to follow along, I'm going to be doing this for the next couple episodes. You can definitely download a free copy of what I came up with, which, you know, I've had a couple of requests for it already, so this is the easiest way to do it. So if you're on Facebook, go to Dominique Henderson CFP, that's my business page, and then what you're going to do is send me a message. Once the message thing pops up, type in 20 myths, 20 myths, M-Y-T-H-S, and you'll get the download right there. So that's as easy as I can make it for right now. So anyways, as I was writing through those, I think I originally posted something on Facebook maybe around Memorial Day saying that I was going to come out with this. And then I thought it'd be kind of easy to kind of not easy, but apropos, if you will, to kind of unpack some of these further. Obviously, I'm only giving a few sentences on every myth so that the guide is not 200 pages. It would be more like a novel instead of a guide. But I thought it would be just fun banter to kind of go through some of this stuff that I've talked about or at least heard about and talked with prospective clients about. So before we dig into that, let's kind of talk about what a myth is. And, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, this audience is sophisticated that is listening to me or watching, and we all know kind of what myths are. You know, there's some type of what we'll call untruth that needs to be dispelled. And let's talk about what people hold on to myths for. So, yeah, along those lines, like, why do we hold on to myths in our mind? Why do they get our attention? And then, you know, things of that nature. So, right. So what is it in your mind that causes you to, with like a kung fu like type grip, hold on to a myth, no matter what that may be? Now, let's separate these two things, because some things that, you know, that are caused by a fight or flight type of response. So, you know, you infer or you deduce that because the stove is hot, if you touch it, it will burn you, right? That's a good thing. Like, and you need to be able to do that really quickly without having to sort through large pieces of knowledge or data. But on the other hand, there are some things that we hold on to more on the side of what I created these myths about when it comes to just how things work. Usually we form these opinions that are our myths. Without a lot of information, unfortunately, that happens, because that's just part of the human nature. I'm not pointing fingers or throwing stones, because I do the same thing. So it's just kind of helpful sometimes to go through the actual logical process by which you've established this quote unquote fact in your mind about something, right? So that's what we're going to kind of do. I just want to set you up. That's what we're going to do with each of these myths, is we're going to kind of establish what the, first of all, we're going to state what the myth is, and then we're going to kind of establish what the real facts are around it. And then you can just judge for yourself based on those facts that I've presented, just like a lawyer, whether or not your myth needs to be held on to anymore. So that's fair, right? So, like I said, if you want a copy, go to Dominique Henderson CFP, which is my Facebook business page, and you can send me a message and type in 20 myths, and that will get you started on getting the download there. So I think where we'll start is, why don't we start with myth one, okay? So myth one, in my guide, I wrote that my money, like, this is just something, again, contextually, these are conversations I've had over almost a two-decade career in financial services, right? So there's this notion out there that my money is safer with a financial advisor from a larger firm, right? So there's independent financial advisors like myself. There's financial advisors that are attached to large broker-dealer or financial institutions like Fidelity or Merrill Lynch or Bank of America, Wells Fargo, blah, blah, blah. The list goes on and on. So, you know, what makes that person that's attached to a financial institution or a larger firm, let's say, a safer bet when it comes to placing your funds or your financial plan or a purveyor or somebody that supplies you with financial advice, right? What dictates the level of safety there? Well, first of all, there is no indication of a level of safety that you can draw from somebody's affiliation with a large or small firm. That's just what it is, right? Because at the end of the day, the individual, and I can just tell you how this works, the individual is going to be insured. They're going to have some type of professional liability insurance, which is called errors and omissions. And there's different limits and levels to that extent. But what that insurance covers is errors and omission, not fraud, right? And so when we talk about money being safer with the financial advisor, there's two ways you can draw this. It can be things that have happened intentionally by the advisor, like fraudulent activity, or things that have happened unintentionally, which is covered by that errors and omissions. Let's deal with the former first, right? So the former is very easy to kind of lay out, right? Because this whole notion around relative safety is really wrapped up in one word, and that's trust, right? So you trust in an individual to a certain degree in order to handle your finances or to invest your money. And if you really just kind of dissect what makes a great financial advisor, it's going to be someone that's trustworthy, so that you can trust, and then somebody that's competent, that's able to do the job that you've hired them to do. There is no affiliation with firm size on those two factors. I mean, you can argue with me if you want, feedback at djhendersonsr.com. Feel free to send me an email. But like, I don't know how you could really stand on a sound argument to say that because I'm affiliated with a larger or smaller firm that you should trust me more, or that I'm more trustworthy, rather, or more competent. Like, that's going to be on an individual basis, right? Yeah, I've worked at firms where you have varying degrees of competency between, you know, advisor 1 through 20. So that has really nothing to do with it, all associated with the same firm. So as a consumer of financial services, what you're going to have to do is do the homework, roll up your sleeves, and actually look into the background and the expertise and the level of competency of that particular financial advisor you want to work with. And then you're going to have to go through some things, you know, pretty much like the sniff test to understand whether or not that person is trustworthy. It's the same thing you would do for a normal relationship to determine the level of trust you want to place with somebody and or transfer to them to handle things for you, right? So let's just dispel the myth once and for all that your money's safer with the financial advisor from a larger firm, right? That's just what makes you feel good. That's just the public perception. And this myth falls into the category of what I would call general perception, general public perception myths, right? Things that are just, you know, the marketing machine, if you will, or whatever, has driven so much attention to one myopic area about firm size when it really has nothing to do with anything. So that's just my two cents. You should weigh all the factors of firm size, professional designations, experience of the advisor, you know, just their bedside manner, all this type of things. You should weigh all those independently and then come to a conclusion that you think will work for you and your situation. So hopefully we've unpacked that successfully enough. Let's move on to myth 4. I'm not going to go through all these myths, as you probably realize, but just kind of hitting on some of the ones that are, you know, I guess more topical for what we're trying to address on this podcast. Okay, so myth 4 is, let's pull it up. I have a tax professional, same as a financial advisor, right? No, not necessarily. Okay. So I think the best way to kind of think about this is when you want expert advice in a specific area, you go to a person that is versed in that area, right? So let's just move away from financial services altogether, right? So today is a good example. I take my daughter to a appointment with an oral surgeon. Different than a dentist, different than any other person that studies medicine. Although under the umbrella of medicine, they all cohabitate, right? They're all there. However, you got people that work on different parts of the body or different parts of, you know, inside your body or whatever. So today we go to an oral surgeon because they specifically specialize in extracting teeth in our particular instance. And that's what we went to them for. Well, why would you assume that the person that is well adept at tax prep and accountancy and bookkeeping could be the same person with a skill set that would equally be serve you as well on investing, 401k allocations, employer benefits? Those are two different specialties, right? So like, for instance, when I'm giving advice that goes beyond just finances, right? Because there's different things that go into your financial plan as far as estate planning or tax strategy or things of that nature, where I don't have an expertise, I'll tell you clearly that I'm drawing a line here and that you need to seek the advice of an expert. And so what this boils down to is you should not look at tax advice, financial advice, legal advice, all in one particular vacuum. They are separate. They integrate together, obviously, in order to get you to where you want to go. But you're going to have to seek out an expert that either has skills in those areas that you seek. Now, that's not to say that your tax advisor, say a CPA, can also be a certified financial planner. That's definitely possible. But to assume right off the bat that this person has these skills without you verifying that first would be a mistake. And that is a myth that I believe I've run across quite often, which, you know, you have a person that does a really great job with your tax strategy, saves you some money, does it pretty, you know, economically as far as you're concerned. And then you also lean on them for other types of advice, which hopefully they are telling you that, you know, hey, This is not my area of expertise, especially if it isn't. You need to seek the advice of a professional. I think it's just human nature that when we place trust in somebody for something and they do a good job on execution, it's only natural to start placing more trust in their arena. And if you're not aware, that that person could take advantage of you. Hopefully they're not, but you would just need to be aware of that. So I think that the myth that just because you have a tax professional, you have a financial advisor, obviously that's not true unless that tax professional also specializes in giving financial advice. So let's move on to myth five. And I'm going to take a swig of water because I'm having dry throat, unfortunately. All right, so we'll wrap up today with myth five. I think I like this one because in the world that we live in, there's been a lot of play media-wise around this. So I'm going to take a little time to unpack this, and hopefully we'll wind it up. So myth five is that financial advisor fees are too expensive. It's better to just invest in index funds. And, you know, index funds, let's kind of unpack some of these terms a little bit. You know, the fees that an advisor gets, we're just going to put those on one umbrella, the fees for service, right? There's different ways that they can be compensated. I've done podcasts on that before. Feel free to Google and or research or look that up on YouTube so that you can kind of go through some of that content if you don't have context for how financial advisors are paid. But suffice to say, are fees that a financial advisor paid relative to where you could do something by yourself, is that too expensive? And that's kind of the notion or the myth that we're going to dispel here. Is it better to just passively invest on your own in things like index funds, which Vanguard is a big purveyor of index funds? So this is what I kind of articulated in the guide that I gave out. Just because the efficiency of a particular function does well with executing on a goal, right? For instance, you would not call up somebody on the phone to execute a trade for you for $35 or $40 when you can just, you know, do it from your smartphone, right? So that makes trading, the function, very efficient. You should not mistake efficiency of a function for advice and the value around advice, because those two things are independent of each other, right? I would use the same, almost the same mechanism to execute a trade for people I give financial advice to, because I'm just taking advantage of the technology. But because the technology is there and you can take advantage of it, does not replace the function that I serve or any other financial advisor serves with giving financial advice to somebody. So here's a further way to unpack that. So let's just say, and I think most people are going to agree with me here. It seems like I'm like kind of lobbing you up a meatball, but just go with me for now. So if you knew you had 20 years left to live on this earth, and you wanted to just, your goal at that point, knowing that you had 20 years left, was to just guarantee a quality of life for your remaining time, right? You spend time with the friends and family that you want. You do the work that you want. All that kind of stuff is already included, right? You got 20 years left, and you just wanted to guarantee that whatever makes you happy, right? All those things, the fill in the blank, the friends, the job, the type of money you need, all that kind of stuff, that's all individually preferenced, right, for whoever the situation fits. It's just that you want to guarantee that stayed in place. So with that being the case, if you knew you had 20 years to live and you just want to guarantee a certain quality of life, which one would you choose? Would you choose the self-management of your financial nest egg and affairs to make sure that guaranteed minimum quality of life was done, just so you can save money? So the goal in the first scenario is the lowest cost solution in order to guarantee what you want, right? So that's choice number one, with the primary concern of saving money. Or would choice number two be more what you want to do, which would be to hire somebody, a competent advisor, obviously, somebody that you can trust, to which you can transfer the responsibility of self-managing so that you can get more bang for your buck proverbially maximizing those remaining years, right? So on one hand, you have, I'll do it myself, and I'll do two things. I'll save myself money, and I'll execute on providing myself the quality of life that I want for these remaining 20 years, or hand that over to somebody that's competent, obviously for more cost, but at the other end, I get to maximize those 20 years. I don't have to even worry about any responsibility around trying to find the best solution to maintain my quality. I don't have to do any of that, right? So that's a real wordy way to say one way is saving money, the other one is maximizing time. Most people are going to choose two. If you don't choose two, that's okay. It just means that me and you won't hang out because you're weird. I'm sorry. You're just weird. Given 20 years to live, most people are going to choose number two because at the end of the day, time is the most precious commodity, and you want to maximize that with the things that you love to do and things that are meaningful, the meaningful relationships that you have. That's what it's going to boil down with. And so although that seems like an obvious choice, that's essentially what we all have. Whether it's 5, 10, 20, 50 years left, that's essentially what you have. That's the situation you're faced with. You're faced with, do I take what I know or have the potential to learn in my remaining years to do this at the most cost-effective method possible and guarantee myself this quality of life that I want? Or do I transfer this risk over a set period of time, it doesn't have to be immediate, to somebody that's more competent than I, that has already studied this and done this many times over with other people, and just pay a fee so that I can fully maximize the remaining time I have doing the things that I love and, you know, that are more meaningful to me. It's almost like a no-brainer once you put it in that context, but in actuality, when you choose to self-manage, you're choosing number one. That's just what you're doing. And so I think, you know, when we're talking about dispelling the whole entire myth around financial advice being too expensive relative to what you can invest in, you know, you have to think about this. And I tell prospective clients this all the time. Financial advising is not just investments. Now, there are financial advisors that just focus on that aspect. That's true. But when we're talking about financial advice in the macro sense of the word, the way I think of it is it's four things really that obviously encompass much more than what I'm about to say, but it's really four categories. It's how cash flow is managed. It has to be managed effectively because you need cash all your life. It's how your investments are positioning because you need the highest level return for your particular goal. We'll get into the next segment of some of these myths talking about beating the market because that has to do with that particular segment of financial planning, investment positioning. The other thing is tax strategy. You don't need to pay more than your fair share while you're here down here living. Whether you're Republican, liberal, or Democrat, you know, money in your pocket for your plan is better than in somebody else's pocket is basically the point. And last but not least, you have to protect your assets. You have to be thinking about risk in a way that if you woke up on a cloud tomorrow, that the people that are left in the wake of that won't be economically disadvantaged, right? So those are the four aspects of financial planning that you as a person are responsible for devising some type of plan in order for your affairs to be in order, whether you choose to execute that on your own, which some people do, or you hire somebody in to give you expert advice on those areas. So that's part one of myths about financial advice and financial advisors. Hopefully you've enjoyed it. If you want to continue the discussions, there's a couple ways to do this. The first is I highly recommend that you get the whole PDF guide where I've illuminated 20 of these myths, and I'm only going to go through a couple on each podcast, and we'll do this for probably the next couple shows. But you can, like I said, go to my Facebook page, Dominique Henderson CFP, send me a message, type in 20 myths. That's how you get that. You can also join the Facebook group, which is Creating Your Roadmap to Financial Contentment, which is a way to get access to me so we can talk about this or other subjects offline. You can always obviously subscribe to our YouTube channel or to the blog. We're on iTunes. We're all over the place. There's so many ways to get in contact with us if you want to talk about this or anything else. But for now, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. And we'll see you back next time. Bye-bye.